You're listening to Trek FM.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Has become convinced that there is a great power hidden in the earth, left here by the gods, waiting to be seized by a superior man. So when he hears about my formula and what it can do, he cannot resist. Schmidt must become that superior man.
Did it make him stronger?
Yeah. But there were other effects. The serum was not ready. But more important, the man. The serum amplifies everything that is inside. So good becomes great. Bad becomes worse. This is why you were chosen. Because the strong man who has known power all his life may lose respect for that power. But a weak man knows the value of strength and knows compassion.
Thanks, I think.
Welcome, everyone, to the 602 Club, Trek FM's local watering hole. I'm so excited to be here tonight. We've got some amazing things to talk about, and just love being back. I hope everybody will forgive me this week, feeling a little under the weather, so I just bear with me, but I couldn't miss the show. You'll understand why once we get there. But before we do, I just want to remind everybody, the 602 Club is part of the Trek FM network, and you can find all the shows at iTunes.com/Trek FM. We're a feature provider there on iTunes. While you're in iTunes, hit us up with a star rating and review. That really helps out the show and makes it easier for people to find when they're looking for different shows. So definitely do that. We'd really appreciate that. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We're online at Trek FM. We've also got the Babel Conference, which is our listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel in the search field on Facebook, and we can let you right in there to that closed group for all of our listeners here at Trek FM. And then, of course, if you'd like to send us an email, just go to trek.fm/contact. Choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that'll come straight to me, and get to correspond with you back and forth, maybe hear about what you thought about the subject tonight, and maybe even something you'd love to hear us talk about on the show. And of course, you can go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM to leave us a voicemail as well. Well, I'm excited because we are going to continue with Marvel this week, and we have a huge film coming up. And Bruce, are you ready for a Civil War?
I am so ready for a Civil War, and I'm living in Atlanta, where Civil War is such a big deal, and I'm glad that we're going to concentrate on a different Civil War instead of the American Civil War.
Yeah, that one wasn't great. Lots of people died in that one, and glad that it was fought, but I'm glad we're not fighting that Civil War. But yes, Captain America Civil War is going to be coming out soon, and it behooves us to talk about the Captain America films, and I'm really excited to be able to do that with Captain America, the First Avenger. And I wanted to ask you, Bruce, because for me, I was never a huge Marvel fanboy growing up. Like, I knew the DC characters much better, and, you know, there were certain Marvel characters that I knew, like Captain America, or I think Spider-Man, obviously, and then, of course, I think probably the other one that I kind of knew a little bit about was Hulk, but really just wasn't all that familiar. So when their films started to come out, it really was kind of an education for me. And then, of course, I started to learn more and more as they came out. And was the same for you, or had you dove into the Marvel Universe comics-wise before the films had come out?
I was a huge Superman fan. So when I was into comic books, I was totally Superman. I had subscriptions to every Superman title, Justice League, DC Comics Presents, World's Finest. That's what I was into. So I dabbled in some other comics in the DC universe. And I would sometimes go to Marvel, but at that time, and we're talking late 70s, early 80s, when I was really deep into the comics, all my friends were Marvel. Every single one of them. I heard about Doctor Strange. I heard about Avengers. I heard about every Marvel line out there, but I was the only one not reading them, or I would occasionally read them. So I really wasn't that familiar with Captain America. I mean, I knew him from the surface, knew generally about him. I don't even recall there being any cartoons on TV that featured Captain America. So he was something, he was someone I was just fairly familiar with. I knew some of the history of the creation of his character. I knew he wasn't owned by Marvel when he first launched. I think he was on a comic book company that was purchased by Marvel. And so he was one of their, I guess, one of the earliest Marvel characters in the Marvel universe.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, not all that familiar. So I was very anxious to go in and see this movie when it first came out because I wanted to know more about Captain America and would I really like him or wouldn't I?
Well, it's really interesting, too, because, you know, this film is something that's a little bit different than everything else that we have gotten in the Marvel Universe up to that point. Because for the most part, the majority of the films take place on kind of a present day Earth. You know, obviously, Thor has parts that take place in Asgard, but a good portion of the film also takes place on Earth. Circa 2000, whenever they were filming, I can't remember at this point. But to really have this Captain America film that's going to really play as an extended flashback was a really interesting idea. And, you know, to me, the more I learned about Captain America, the more I was kind of glad that they stayed with the very classic origin of Captain America. You know, that he's that scrawny guy and World War II time period who wants to go to war, but nobody will let him. And, you know, he gets picked up for a special scientist program and turned into the only super soldier that we've ever had. And, you know, I thought that that was a really great way to go and kind of a bold move. You know, at that point, period type pieces, you know, weren't all the rage. You know, to do like a throwback film like this, like World War II or something like that. So I think a bold move for Marvel, but I'm glad that they went a little bit different with Captain America.
It's almost like they had to do that. I'm sure initially when they were considering making a Captain America movie, they wanted to present him in the present day and time because you are taking a risk by having it take place in an older past period of time. World War II, our most general audiences, especially the younger generation, wanting to go see a superhero movie that takes place during World War II? Probably not. They probably want to see it more modern day. But with Captain America, that's what Captain America is all about. Captain America was created, hence the name Captain America. He was created, that character was originally created to portray fighting against Hitler and fighting against the enemies of World War II on behalf of the United States of America. So he's very patriotic. And what better way to introduce this character than to put him in the setting that he was built and modeled for? But at the same time, introducing the chapters at the beginning, at the end of the film, to show that he is also part of our modern day universe. So starting off the film, it starts off modern day today and then takes that look back. And I think it's so appropriate and worked so well to have him in that environment.
No, I really do agree with you. And I think one of the cool things about what they decide to do with the character is that it also helps explain, I think it explains who the character is at his very core. You know, like they don't change Steve Rogers at all. He's the same as he was in the comics, and that's going to be really important once we get to the Avengers films. And he is kind of this man out of time, but he's also this man who is very firmly rooted and grounded in a sense of morality and virtue that have kind of gone by the wayside. So that's going to come really big into play in the Avengers films. But what I love, too, just speaking about the idea of having this setback in World War II, by kind of setting up throughout this film the heightened technology that you have, it actually helps you buy, I think, the later films. Like, you know, when you're talking about Iron Man and, you know, obviously the Incredible Hulk is really based off their work of trying to create another super soldier. They even reference Captain America. You know, those kind of things, I think that enhanced science that we see back in World War II and all of that helps explain why, you know, Marvel is kind of in an alternate universe, really, because it's not really our world, you know, and so it does a great job of just setting up that science had moved a little bit farther along than we have even now by World War II, and then, of course, when we get into the other film. So I just think it was a wise decision all around, and mainly, too, it just doesn't mess with the Cap origin story. I think it really pulls the best of all the things from that origin story, and it really lets it shine. And I think, to me, that was the best part of this film. And it was a nice change of pace. You know, when I was talking about the idea, it's a little bit different. I think it helped set this one apart from Thor and Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk, and it gave it a completely different feel, which was great, you know, at this point, because, you know, we're four films in. We've had two Iron Mans, an Incredible Hulk, and a Thor. You know, it's great that this film does feel completely different.
It's very opposite of Thor, with Thor feeling very mystical, sci-fi, taking place in a different universe. And of course, Thor does come to our universe and participates in that environment for most of that movie. But now we're seeing Captain America take place in a more grounded historical universe of our time, of our past century. And I think for me watching that, I think it was kind of nostalgic in the fact that comic books really took off with superheroes and comic books in that period of time, the late 30s and into the 40s. And to see a superhero movie take place in that time just made it feel right. It felt like it should start there. And it's funny you said about how it isn't really our universe. It kind of shows that it's in a slightly different universe. It's almost as if it was our universe up until this period of time during World War II. All of a sudden, little seeds are planted that start to divert that timeline off of our timeline into something a little more technical, a little more advanced in that technical aspect in that realm. Like you're saying, with going, you know, the seeds of Hulk in there and the seeds of Iron Man in there. It's all there. It's all planted. So to say this movie is the first Avenger, it really is the first Avenger movie. If you look at the scope of all the Avengers together, this is the one that plants those seeds.
Well, it is interesting, too, that they had kind of wanted to film this film first, and Jon Favreau wanted to do Iron Man. And so that's what they went with first.
But was Iron Man really, was it planned to do Avengers at that time? Or did that come after he did the first Iron Man movie?
You know, I'm not sure either. I think, you know, Marvel definitely had, I mean, they had gotten a quite sizable loan, over $500 million, to be able to create their studio and set them on the course for Phase 1. And there were definitely some things that were in flux as they were doing that. You know, again, they had wanted, I think, to start with this film. And it was some rights issues being disputed, and the fact that as they got closer and closer to filming some things, Favreau was approached as a director, but he chose to make Iron Man instead. So, and they had some other things go on, so they ended up doing Incredible Hulk next, and then, of course, Iron Man 2, And, you know, so it's really interesting the way it just ended up working out. But, you know, I could see almost, like if you're watching through the Marvel movies, you know, in a timeline, you know, this is definitely almost the movie you kind of want to watch first because it kind of sets everything else that's going to come up next. So, yeah.
Don't say it. It's a prequel.
It is a prequel. You're right. It is a prequel to all the other films. And yet what's funny is that this was the film that was also leading right into Avengers. And so big deal there for what they were going for. And but I liked having this very different film before we got to Avengers. And part of that, I think, is really something that I've been thinking a lot about with Captain America and the movie is this idea that character matters. You know, Captain America is a character that before he becomes the hero has a very moral and virtuous center. You know, I mean, he's like the paragon of virtue even before he becomes the superhero. He just is too small to do anything about it, you know? And I think that's really cool. And he's also kind of an anomaly in the Avengers in that he willingly chooses the enhancements. He willingly chooses the program, you know. And you think about it, Tony never planned on being Iron Man. He put the arc reactor in his chest to keep him alive. And then he created a suit around that deformity that he ended up having. You know, Hulk definitely never wanted to be the Hulk. And, you know, Thor was born into it. He didn't have a choice, you know. So, but the one thing that's so amazing about Cap is that, you know, Steve Rogers is an incredible guy from beginning to end, and that never changes. And I love that, you know, his strongest part of him isn't his strength that he gets, but it's the virtue inside. And I think that says a lot to our culture these days.
Yeah, I really relate to this character too, and the fact that he is this small little dude at the beginning of this film, and you know, he's getting bullied and picked on, and but he's always had a kind heart. See, that was me way back in the day. I was a small little guy. I was one of the youngest in my class. I got picked on occasionally, some bullies here and there. But I always had a heart of gold, just like Captain America. The only difference is I did not want to join the army and fight a war. So he's got more balls than I do. But that's what's so great about this character. It's like you were saying, so many characters that become superheroes are people that usually accidentally fall into that space. They, you know, something happens in a lab that they weren't expecting, and all of a sudden they discover they have these superhuman powers, or they come from some world where they come to Earth, or something happens to them. There's, you know, few heroes, or something tragic happens to them that they have to become a superhero, a vigilante, and try to save their day and redeem their parents that died, or something to that effect. But here's a guy that's just like, you know what? I'm a small guy. I don't always fit in. And, you know, I have all this energy, all this wanting to make things right. I want to be the best. I'm just physically not there. It's in my heart. It's in my soul. I just don't have that physical ability to make it happen. And then someone says, I can do that for you. And he says, yes, I'm in. Put me in and let's make this happen. And he turns out to be the best of the best. And that's because it's in his heart, it's in his will to be the best superhero. He didn't have it easy through his life, and now he can make a difference and change things.
Well, and it's so cool because, you know, his experience has turned him into somebody who, even though he doesn't have the power to stand up to bullies, he still does. You know, he is somebody who has been molded and crafted into somebody that isn't going to allow people to get away with what they shouldn't be able to get away with. And, you know, it's so cool because, you know, Cap has always known the difference between right and wrong and for standing up for the little guy, even when he was the little guy. And I just think that that's something that's so cool about the character that, and I think makes him the coolest character in Marvel and the best character is that he is somebody, he is like Marvel's Superman. He's the paragon of virtue. And there's nothing that can kind of touch that. And it doesn't mean he's perfect, but it just means that he is a guy who has a moral center that cannot be shaken. You know, and I think that's a really awesome thing. Again, in a world where morality and virtue aren't something we hold into high esteem, I just look at some of the other superheroes in the Marvel universe. Cap is not that guy, you know, and it's going to be interesting because you go right from this into Avengers where he's thrown in with a world of moral relativism and, you know, characters that are all doing things for their own benefit and for their own agenda and stuff. And Cap's just the guy out there who's always just trying to do the best thing for as many people possible, even if it costs him his own life. And just awesome. You know, like I love Captain America because of what he stands for and who he is. And if you do it right, it comes off great. And that's what I think they really do here with this whole thing is Cap is the ultimate Boy Scout. But somehow they're able to make this story really interesting and really relevant and not boring. You know, that's the thing about Superman. People always say that he's boring because he always, you know, he's just a big blue Boy Scout. Cap's the same way, but they made him really interesting. So you can write a character that has a lot of virtue and not make him boring at the same time, you know?
Yeah, that's one thing I was thinking about, too, is people say that Superman's boring. I guess I like Boy Scouts because I really do, of course, mentioned earlier that I really like Superman. And right now I really like Captain America. He's my favorite of the Avengers. And I think just one reason is because they get it right in this movie. They just make a compelling character. They make him interesting. He's somebody that you like. He's somebody that you can relate to and you're rooting for. You want him to win. And you want this poor little skinny guy to be this big superhero, this big powerful soldier that's going to go out there and beat Hydra or even Hitler if he'd had the chance to do that. But I really did enjoy this character. He's definitely up there for me. And Chris Evans does a great job in this role.
Yeah, that's something that I think is really important here was the casting of Chris Evans as Captain America and Steve Rogers. You know, if you don't pick somebody who can be sympathetic as that character, you know, that doesn't make that virtue come off as being kind of a jerk or better than everybody else. Like, it never happens with him. And what's so wonderful is that, you know, even when he gets his powers, people are still telling him, no, you can't do things. You know, that's what's so interesting. Like, he's still facing the same issues once he gets his powers and he has to go out there and he has to prove himself, you know? And Chris Evans just brings a heart and a soul to this guy that is really special. You know, there are certain characters that we think of in our heads as the people that played them. And I think Chris Evans for Captain America, for a really long time, you're just going to think him. You know, like, I don't know who's going to surpass that one day, but it's going to be a really tough job because Chris Evans is fantastic.
And, you know, I just realized right now that I forgot he was in the first Fantastic Four films. He was the Human Torch. And I remember going into this movie thinking, oh, it's the Human Torch. It's the guy from Fantastic Four. And I've got to know him so well as Captain America that I forget that he was in the Fantastic Four movies.
It is nice that his performance and everything about the Captain America movies is so good that you forget the Fantastic Four films. You know,
I even forgot there was one this past summer.
Yeah, well, that one was totally forgettable. So anyway, go back and listen to that show. It was fun. So on top of Chris Evans, though, playing the role of Captain America, as we talked about, doing just such a fantastic job. I mean, the cast here is really amazing. They picked out some great character actors. And for me, every time I watch this film, I don't know, for some reason, I forget that Tommy Lee Jones is in it. It's Chester Phillips. And then I'm immediately reminded because everything he does is awesome. It's like he's in the Lego movie. Everything is awesome.
Yeah, it's funny you said that, too, because I forgot that he was in this movie, too. I started watching it, and I was like, oh, Tommy Lee Jones. That's right. How can I forget that he's in that? I don't know what that says about him. I mean, I think he's great in this film, but I don't know why I forget that he's there. Maybe because he doesn't carry over to the other films, and we forget about that. I don't know. But he's just so awesome in every... See, look, you even said awesome. You sang awesome, and now awesome's in my head. That's the only thing I can say about him. He's awesome, and he's a crusty old guy. But, you know, in a lot of ways, his characters are all the same. They're all Tommy Lee Jones, and that's okay. Just put Tommy Lee Jones as Tommy Lee Jones in any movie, and it's going to work.
Well, what's great about him is, like you said, you know, he's not going to carry over into the other Cap films. And you need somebody that immediately has gravitas and that kind of, like, gravelly, gritty nature of his. But he is also, like, you think that somewhere underneath all of that, there's just a big teddy bear waiting to get a hug, you know? And... He's able to do all of those things in this role. And the way that he cares about the men under his command, obviously, Haley Atwell's, Peggy Carter under his command, everybody, you know, he's trying to take care of all of these people and help win this war. And everything he does, like, it's comedic gold, it's dramatic gold, it's just gold. So more things for Tommy Lee Jones, because he's just awesome. Which leads me, you know, to kind of talk about Haley Atwell playing Peggy Carter. And you know, after so much time now with Peggy Carter for both seasons of Agent Carter, I just, you know, I love Haley Atwell. And I think she was just the perfect choice to play Peggy Carter, because... man, does she go toe-to-toe with everybody and do such a good job.
Oh, yeah, she's up there with them. She can stand up to them and just, you can tell that she's in control, that she's a tough woman. Even that first scene that you see her in, and that one big dude, you know, kind of flirts with her and takes her on, doesn't take her seriously. Like, what, a woman's going to give us commands and tell us what to do? And she just, boom, takes him down. And I'm like, yeah, you go. You do that. You take him down, girl. You do that. But, you know, here's the thing about that I don't like about Peggy Carter. No, don't get me wrong. I do like Peggy Carter. But I never got to watch the Agent Carter series yet, because I put it on the DVR, and then my wife deleted them after she watched them. But I didn't get to watch them. So it's kind of like a sore spot for me right now, because I have to go and watch those now, because her performance really is good. And she's very attractive. I mean, I would go back to the 1940s and kiss her too, just like Cap did. But, well, he didn't go back. He was already there. But yeah, she's very tough, takes control, great character.
Well, and what's great is that they give her this position and they give her this strength that comes out, and she can do anything that the guys do, but it's not a big production or anything like that. It's just they do such a good job with the character, you immediately buy it. And they picked the right actress who had the right inner strength to be able to pull it off, and it, you bought, you know? And that's, I think that's one of the things that, for the most part, a lot of these Marvel films have done, is if they have done a really good job with the side casting and just the casting in general. And that's a big part of superhero films. You know, if your cast doesn't work, people aren't going to be as invested. And luckily, Peggy Carter and Haley Atwell just kind of draw you into that character. And for me, even though the Agent Carter series isn't as strong as I'd like it to be, especially the second season, it's her that really kept me coming back, because she's such a great actress, and I really want to see her continue to be able to do more things. And if they give her another season, I hope they really find their groove, because she definitely deserves great material. And I think they just gave that to her here in the writing of the film. Well, we've got Sebastian Stan, which doesn't seem like a real name. Sebastian Stan.
Sebastian Shaw.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But he plays Bucky Barnes, you know, the good friend of Captain America, which I love. And then you look at the old comics, the Bucky Barnes is like this plucky little kid that's his sidekick.
Yeah, he's like Robin for Batman.
Exactly. And they definitely don't go that way at all. But I feel like they chose somebody who could play the different sides, you know, the guy who is the one protecting Steve at the beginning, and then the guy who's being protected by Steve by the end. You know, they just really picked a great actor who had a good range, and which obviously was really important as you get into Winter Soldier, and you really need to be able to buy this guy as, like, you know, badass. And yeah, I really liked him. You know, he doesn't have a ton to do in this film, but I think he does it really well. And then the fact that they bring him back, yeah, great job by him.
Yeah, he really does a great job playing a good friend. Somebody who, it's almost like he's an older brother to Steve Rogers, and then later the roles reverse. And he balances that so well. He's consistent with the character, but to the point that he doesn't overplay it to be this guy that is much bigger and broader and maybe tougher than Steve in the beginning, that they're just good friends. And then when the roles reverse, he doesn't downplay it. He still keeps it there at that level, that he's still that same guy, but also doesn't underplay it to make it seem as if he's less than Steve or Captain America at that point. So he does a really great job. Chemistry between the two works well, and it's believable. He dies, but like you said, he comes back. So really great. I don't want to go ahead, jump into the other movies, but yeah, great performance.
Yeah, yeah. Spoiler alert, he dies and then comes back. So, but that happens in a lot of comic book movies.
Yeah, a lot.
Well, I liked, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, Iron Man 2 had come out and John Slattery had played a older Howard Stark. And so they brought in Dominic Cooper to play Howard Stark, like, in his prime. And man, does he do a good job of really feeling like Tony, you know? I think that the mannerisms that he has and everything like that kind of bring you to believe that this is Tony's dad, you know? I think he plays it so well, and he's very funny. And it was great casting, because there's nothing, he really is setting the stage for who Tony is going to be through the first two films. And I thought that was, it's interesting to play, to see it in, you know, retrospect, because we've already seen Iron Man 1 and Iron Man 2 at this point, but it works really well. I think they cast well, found the right guy to bring that character to life. So you bought him as Tony Stark's dad.
Yeah, I don't think I have really anything more to add to what you just said. You're exactly right. I mean, he reminds you of Tony Stark, the way his mannerisms are, the way he looks. I actually buy the fact that they could be related. It's not like he's an actor that looks like, that guy doesn't look like he could be Tony Stark's father. They look nothing alike. You can see some of that resemblance there, and the mannerisms and the way he moves and the way he talks really supports that. And again, he's another one of those seeds, another seed in this movie that's leading to these other characters, these other Avengers in the other movies. And so there's a great connection between this character into the Iron Man films.
Well, and I have to say, you know, they have Neil McDonough in the film playing Dum-Dum as is one of the main Howling Commandos. And all I can say is that he's just not in the film enough. I love, love, love Neil McDonough. And, I mean, he was in Star Trek First Contact. He was in Flag of Our Fathers. He's in Arrow right now. And the guy is really phenomenal. He's a great actor. And I'm sad that he wasn't in more things, because he was also in Band of Brothers as well. And the guy is just outstanding as an actor. And if somebody's never seen Band of Brothers, you need to go out and watch Band of Brothers. He plays Buck Compton and just is fantastic. So I knew him coming into the film because of Band of Brothers. And it may be a little sad that he didn't have more to do in this film.
I was surprised. It's been a couple of years since I watched this movie, and when he showed up on screen, I was like, oh yeah, here we go, you know? And all of a sudden, I started realizing we're not going to see that much of him. And for some reason, I remembered him having more to do. At least that was the impression I had. I think because he has such a great character that it just stood out to me. So when I watched the film again, it was surprising to me what little he had. Not that he was a very small part, but he just comes across as something bigger that you would expect to see more of him and more of this character in there. But yeah, this actor, Neil's great. Yeah, he's a great performer. Like you said, I've been enjoying him lately in Arrow. And he'll always be Lieutenant Hawk from First Contact for me.
Oh, poor Lieutenant Hawk. It sucks when you get turned into a Borg and then killed.
Yep. Yeah. It just sucks you right out into space.
Does. Well, I love that they used Stanley Tucci as Abraham Erskine. And he's just, you know, Stanley Tucci can be in anything, and he's just good. And he has such a way, especially in the conversations that he's having with Steve about when they're the day before they're going to have the procedure done for Steve. And they're sitting there on the bed and they're having this conversation and they're talking about why he came over to America and all of those things that, you know, it was really nice because he's also the person that recognizes the specialness of Steve before anybody else, you know, that he is the one that should be the super soldier because he's the one who's already super. He just doesn't have a way to play it out in his life, you know? Like, Steve is already a superhero. He just doesn't have the body of a superhero. And I love that Stanley Tucci sees that because this wonderful thing of talking about how the serum brings out what you already have in you, you know? And if you have badness, it just makes it more bad. But if you have goodness, it makes it more good. And, you know, Steve already has as much goodness as any human can have, really. And I love that his character sees that and the way he plays it. And it's so sad that he dies because I would have really liked to have seen him play more. Obviously, that's just kind of the way it goes with a comic book origin story. And they need him to die so they can't make any more super soldiers. And Steve can be the only one. So. But, yeah, he's just phenomenal.
I never thought about him being a super soldier. He would have been a good candidate for that. Maybe in an alternate universe we can see that story. That would be interesting to me. Matt, you'll like what I'm about to say now because I'm going to do a Star Wars reference. This character is the Obi-Wan Kenobi of this film. He is the mentor, and he dies. So just like in A New Hope. So very similar. He's showing Steve that he has it in him to be this and that he's the right choice. And he is, in some respects, the chosen one for this. And then he gets killed. And then Steve has to do this on his own. He has to stand on his own and go by the wisdom of what Stanley's character told him.
That's a great point. That's a really great point. It's really interesting to see that play out throughout the film. I love that read that there is a Star Wars-ness to it, that you have the guy who nobody thinks he's anything special, but somebody else knows he's special, sees it in him, gives him the ability, the power to make it special, like showing him the Force. Yeah, that's really, I like that a lot. But I think what's great about it too is it shows the way in which this film, I think, really harkens back to a lot of the archetypes to which classic films and stories use. And they do the hero's journey here with Steve. I think they do it really, really well. You know, this is a big hero's journey for Steve Rogers, and going somebody who always wanted to be the person that people could rely on. He could protect them, but he could never do that. And now he can. And then also dealing with the ramifications of having that power and not necessarily being able to save everyone, you know, because obviously he doesn't save Bucky, or at least you know, he thinks Bucky's dead. And so I love the hero's journey that we get here with Steve, and the fact that, you know, the struggle of dealing with being a super powered person and having it impact your life. Like, I love the scene where he's in the bar and it's all bombed out and he's drinking. He's like, I can't even get drunk, you know? And she's like, well, yeah, that's because your metabolism is burning like 4,000 calories a day. So yeah, but I just, the things that Steve has to go through to become the hero are just, it's a great story, and I really, really like it.
And that bar scene was one of my favorites, because when he said he couldn't get drunk, I thought, oh, well, you know, I guess that's kind of the price you pay. And then when she says that his metabolism is like 4,000 calories, I was like, you know what? I'll take that, especially since I'm on a diet right now. I like to burn as much fat as I possibly can. So if I didn't ever have to get drunk to do that, that's just perfectly fine with me. Just pass over that chocolate cake.
Yeah, me too. I'm right there with you, man, because I'm not a person who likes to drink to get drunk anyway. I just like the way it tastes. So, you know, yeah, if I could have my cake and eat it too, that's perfect. So sign Bruce and I up for Super Soldier
Serum. Yeah, let's do it.
So that's what we're saying. Well, the villain here, you know, Hugo Weaving is Johann Schmidt, or the Red Skull, I think is really interesting as a villain, especially in the Marvel universe, because he is about as Bond supervillain as it gets. I mean, what's interesting is he's playing next to Hitler in this film, because we're during World War II. And the fact that somehow they make him feel almost worse than Hitler is kind of crazy. I mean, not with the concentration camps or anything, but I mean, he's just going to kill anybody who stands in his way. It doesn't even matter. He's not going to put him in camps. They're just going to die. This guy is bad. And what I liked is that he's a strong villain. You know, I don't feel like the Marvel films, for the most part, except for Loki, have really great villains. I feel like this guy is a really strong villain. You know, anytime you have a guy who's wanting to take over the entire world and has a good plan to do it, and there's only one guy to stop him, that's not bad, you know, especially in a superhero movie. And I feel like they just make it work.
And in the beginning of the movie, they establish what a badass he is. I mean, he goes and he gets the artifact that he needs, and then he kills everyone in the village. He didn't have to do that. Already, you know that this is a dangerous guy, that we need to really be fearful of his wrath. And you're right. I mean, Hitler is the ultimate bad guy. He works for Hitler, but now he's superseding him. And and now even Hydra seems to be more threatening than the Nazis are. So to pull that off in a movie that takes place during World War II, I mean, Hitler and Nazis are bad enough as it is. Now you've got this guy with Hydra. I mean, he's going to take over the whole world, including Berlin. When they're like, wait, why is Berlin on the map? He's like, I'll show you why. And he shoots all the Nazis that came in, or the officers from Germany that came in to see his new inventions. So he was very much in strength equal to Captain America. So, of course, when you have to have those fighting scenes, they have that same strength that they can fight with each other. But he's the opposite of Cap. Cap had a good soul, got the strength, and it just enhanced his goodness. And this enhanced our villain's badness. And therefore, he is the Red Skull.
Well, and it's funny, you never think of Hitler making a deal with the devil, but that kind of happens
in
this film.
You're right. This is the devil.
Yeah. I mean, he really plays that well. And I love, too, you know, the fact that they actually reference Raiders of the Lost Ark at the beginning of the film, where he's like, let Hitler, who is obsessed digging for his trinkets in the desert, have them, and, you know, something like that. And as he's looking at the Tesseract, and I love that they're actually referencing Raiders of the Lost Ark at that point. So
even that scene felt like Raiders of the Lost Ark or something from Indiana Jones.
It really does. It really does. And that leads us right into the director here. You know, Joe Johnson worked on the original Star Wars, and he worked on the visual effects. And then, of course, he worked on the Indiana Jones series, and then he directed The Rocketeer, which is one of my favorite films. And you can really see the influences here that he... I really think he was the right person for the job to make this work, to make it believable and make it fun, because it has that Indiana Jones Rocketeer with a side of Star Wars kind of feel to it, like you were talking about. Like, it's really... You have somebody, I feel like, who understands the pulp genre. And like you said, you know, the 30s and the 40s were the highlight for the golden age for comics. And I feel like he's doing such a great job of bringing that together. And I really like his direction here. And I think he does a fantastic job of making a period piece film work, because he's putting it in the same light as something like Indiana Jones or a Rocketeer, which also just work phenomenally.
The way he shoots this movie reminds me of a lot of the films that Steven Spielberg has directed, in the certain style, the certain camera work with it. And, you know, people like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were influenced by films of that era. And Joe Johnson working with these guys and obviously shooting a movie that's taking place in this era. It was the perfect tone. It was the perfect direction. I love some of the work that was done where, you know, he zooms in on certain items, like the car with the medallion on it for Hydra, and the way that zooms in. That reminded me so much of Spielberg and his direction. And not to say that Joe Johnson is Spielberg, I'm not saying that he's copying Spielberg, I'm just saying that there's some similarities there, and that style was so reminiscent of the 30s and the 40s, so it fits so well with this film. I really enjoyed the direction of this, and Joe Johnson's work, even, you know, in special effects, and this is being a special effects movie, you know, things are getting better as we go along with these films, where special effects don't always stand out as, oh, you can tell that's fake, or, oh, you can tell that's CGI. A lot of the films are getting better and better with that. They seem to find the right balance and the right blend. And that certainly was in here. There was a few times when we saw the little Steve Rogers where I could tell it looked a little manipulated, but a lot, most of the time it looked so good and so real.
Well, that's a really big thing to talk about, because, you know, half this film takes place before Steve becomes Captain America. And, you know, before basically he looks like Chris Evans, as we all know what Chris looks like these days, which is phenomenal, let's not lie. And I think it's pretty impressive the way that they were able to make this skinny Steve work, you know, and the different things that they did to make that work. You know, sometimes it was thinning down Chris Evans himself. Sometimes it was putting his head on a smaller guy's body and thinning it all up. Sometimes it was just the body double. Sometimes it was a combination of everything they were doing. And what's great about it is the fact that I was, you know, watching the movie the other day, and I feel like the skinny Steve still works so well. I mean, they really, I feel like for the most part, they did their job to the best of their ability, and it's still holding up today.
Yeah, I agree. It definitely holds up. I can't help but watch Skinny Steve and try to look for imperfections. I can't help but sit there and go, well, okay, I know that's not really Chris Evans. And so I'm constantly watching that going, okay, does that look good? Does that look real? Does that... In some ways, it's distracting when you know that's not really the actor, but it looks so good. It's so believable. And, you know, I almost think that's probably what he looked like when he was 14 years old. It's too bad, you know, he couldn't just go back into the past and grab his 14-year-old self to come and play that part in this movie. But and I actually saw Chris Evans in a movie just this weekend. I don't know what my daughters were watching on Netflix, but it was a movie prior to this. And not to say that he was small, but he was a little smaller than what he is as Captain America. So he really bulked up for this movie.
Yeah, he did. I mean, even those aforementioned Fantastic Four films that we were talking about, he was not this big. And so he definitely changed his body quite a bit for this. And it was interesting because they knew they weren't going to be able to do the thing where, you know, he could get real skinny so he could do the part and then he could bulk up. They just didn't have the time to be able to do that. So they had to think of all these other ways and use the technology to the best of their ability. And I really do. I think it's fantastic and it works so well. Next to that, was interesting to me is that I don't think most of the Marvel films up to this point have had a really strong soundtrack, but this is the one that kind of stands out for me because I can actually remember the theme, the Captain America theme. You know, it's this kind of wonderful, melodic, patriotic feel to it. And I think Silvestri did a pretty good job. And I really wish that I felt like music and soundtracks were more important to the Marvel films, because this one, I think it needed to have a good one. You know, it needed to have something that sounded different, sounded classic. And I think he does a really good job of making that happen. 'Cause you want this soundtrack to feel more like any Indiana Jones or, you know, the Rocketeer or something like that. 'Cause the music is so much a part of those type of films. And so I think Silvestri, for the most part, does a pretty good job for himself.
I'm with you. I would like to see more theme music in a lot of these films. I don't necessarily say that it ruins it if it's not there or that I really miss it, but I do enjoy it quite a bit when it is there. And I did enjoy it in this movie. I never bought the soundtrack to this film, but now that we're talking about it, I'm looking to buy another good soundtrack, so I might just go into iTunes and do that tonight. So it really was a good. I did like the music. It was patriotic, and it felt like it was for the time, and also felt like music for an action superhero movie. So it was a good blend of that, and I even enjoyed the stage performances they were doing as Steve Rogers was going on tour trying to. What was it, bonds or something for the army? Or
yes, selling the bonds. That was great.
Yeah, so that was pretty good too.
Well, and that's the thing that I think, just kind of talking like maybe final thoughts, I guess. But, you know, one of the things that I like about the movie is the way it captured the time period, you know, and bonds, selling bonds was a big deal, you know. We needed money to fund the war and to fight the Axis powers in World War II. And, you know, the fact that everywhere he went, there was a huge bump in bond sales. You know, it's not surprising when you see that guy on stage and you think, oh, that's a representation of what all of our soldiers are like, you know? And I kind of like the slow nature to the film of finally getting him to that point, because, you know, some superhero films, they go so fast to get the character into the suit and all. And here, it really was about the journey for Steve. Like, again, I liked that even when he gets his powers, people are still telling him, no, you can't do things. You know, like that doesn't solve the problems, you know. And Steve has to find a way to be able to show everyone what he can do and what his value is outside of, you know, being in tights on stage selling bonds. And I just really liked that. And the way that they built up to it in this film, so that by the time he goes on the rescue mission, you know, he's using the triangular shield. What's great is, too, they were able to go through different variations of the costume, you know, like doing the stage stuff. He's wearing the classic costume. It looks ridiculous. You know, like, but he gets to wear it on screen until they finally get to the official costume that we'll have for this movie. And I don't know. For me, I think they just do a really great job of telling this story. And it's one of my favorite Marvel films. It's like right up there with Captain America 2. So, in fact, I think these are side by side each other. So, Bruce, if you rated Captain America, the first Avenger, where do you think you'd put it? What would you rate it?
With the other Marvel films?
Or just by itself.
Just by itself? Let's see. I would say I like it a lot. It's one of my favorites. It's not my favorite of the Marvel films, but by itself, I would give it 4.5 shields out of 5.
Nice. That's a good rating. That's a really good rating. So anytime you give a film a 4.5, that's pretty solid. So, you know, for me, yeah, this is my second favorite Marvel film. And I love Captain America. I love the character. I love what he stands for. I love who he is. I love how they portray him. I love the actor playing him. I like his supporting cast. And I think the film was just so successful and it works so well. I really enjoy sitting down to rewatch this one. And I'm right there with you. This is probably 4.75 Tesseracts for me. Like, this is just, it's a great movie. There's really not anything about it that I don't like. So it's almost like the Mary Poppins of films, practically perfect in every way. So
it helps the medicine go down, the sugar that's all in this movie.
That's true. And the Nazis to go down to yes. Get shot. Yeah, exactly.
You fight the Nazis with sugar.
No. Fight them with Captain America's bicep. So well, I'm really glad, you know, we get to talk about these things here on the 602 Club. I'm so excited to be talking about the Cap films till we get to Civil War for just the next few weeks. And I really want to thank our associate producers who allow us to do that. Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson, both associate producers here through Patreon. Now, Patreon is the way in which listeners can support all of the content that's coming to you from Trek FM. Now, we have a lot of different feeds coming to you. We have a lot of different shows, and all of that costs a lot to be able to bring to you each and every week. So go to patreon.com/trekfm and you can see how you can become part of the team and make sure that all of this great content keeps coming to you. We've got some great perks for you. We've got exclusive content, producer credit, seats on the content development team. We've got the Patreon roundtable and so much more. So go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can join us and help make sure all of this comes to you each and every week. Bruce, I love having you back here to the 602 Club. And I know you've got some places that you are online. So before we let everybody go, let everybody know where they can find you.
Well, if I'm not here in the 602 Club, and I've noticed that for some reason on this show, I'm not getting drunk. So maybe I've got that Captain America thing going on right now. But you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Admiral_Rex. And I occasionally do some things over there at StarWarsReport.com.
Awesome, man. Thanks for being here. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing The Orb with Chris Jones here on the network where we talk about Deep Space Nine. I am also on Literary Treks with Dan, and Bruce likes to show up there every once in a while. We're talking about the books and the comics of Star Trek. I also do another show with my friend John Mills over on TheNerdParty.com, and that is called Aggressive Negotiations, and it is all about Star Wars. In fact, we just did our Force Awakens show, so you'll want to check that out on iTunes or at TheNerdParty.com. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear?